far as I can see, because there's nothing to slow the process down. In open air with a one atmosphere gas surrounding it, it's going to equilibrate back at one atmosphere after the lightning and such. So if it was an enclosed space, you might have a point with a vacuum, but since it's an open area with the easy flow of gas, I don't think you get anything close to a vacuum in that environment.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen. Turns out that most of us forget about how heavy air really is. As I said, you ask the average engineer, what does a cubic meter of air weigh? If they haven't got a heavy physics background, they'll guess on average a milligram. It's a kilogram. Kilogram is a million times heavier than a milligram. Air is heavy stuff. You have an experience from your youth that confirms that. Remember when you were a young child and you stuck your hand out the window of a car and the car is moving at 50 miles an hour and you aimed your hand in various ways and the pressure of the air hitting your hand created pounds of pressure. You were deflecting air with your hand at 40 or 50 miles an hour and you felt pounds of pressure. You were getting a little bit of a sense of how heavy air really is. You set air moving rapidly because you created a shock wave. It is a massive fluid moving at a high velocity, and when it strikes something like the Mira building, it will collapse a building and kill 168 people. Or a fuel air bomb can do that. The lightning bolt, if you happen to be broadside to a lightning bolt, my guess is you could measure how much damage it was capable of doing, the shock wave of that expanding air coming off that lightning bolt. Over to you, Wes wanted to make some further comments. Go ahead, Wes.
You made an extremely good point. There is heavy. Heavy like a hell. I have a vacuum chamber. A nice one, big one, glass one. And I did a lot of experience. I have a lot of experience. I also have an electron microscope. So I was really trying to see the certain phenomena. But the thing is that legend up. I'm going to repeat it again. The superheated air causes it to produce a resonating tube of partial vacuum surrounding the lightning path. The nearby air rapidly expands and contracts. This causes that column to vibrate like a tubular drum head and produce a tremendous crack. As the vibration gradually dies out, the sound echoes and reverberances generating the rumbling, that is, we call it a thunder. We can hear the thundering boom, let's say 10 miles away. End of quote, I was reading, let me jump. But because air is heavy, when you create a partial vacuum, you create a different properties for the longitudinal wave, which is the sound wave, to travel. And it's not that it's going to be less in power, it's going to be less in speed, because we have a speed of the sound in air, and that's how we measure it. So what I'm saying is the guy that is in vicinity, he's never going to hear the thunder. And that's my point, because it's a partial vacuum tube, and it takes the time to just that pushed out air come back to where it was before. Dr. Roy.
Well, Wes, you know, I'd hate to be part of that experiment, because I don't think it's a perfect vacuum. I don't think there is a given diameter that you're sort of protected by the outrush of gases. So I tend to disagree. I realize you read it from an article, and I'm sure the guy who wrote it meant it, but I think that it's not exactly... It sounds very good theoretically, but in a practical way, I don't really see a partial vacuum full enough to limit any sound entering. I mean, at what distance from the lightning itself do you think it's silent?
The article was written by Richard Briel, a professor of Honolulu Community College, and he's easy to find on Scientific American. And based on another article, the cube is real. The cube has a huge, humongous variation of the pressure because the air is pushed out. And inside you have ionized lightning. Now, when you look at the ionized lightning, you can look at the rare atmosphere in ionosphere. Let me drop. And then you can see that that ionosphere was ionized because the distance between the particles is humongous. So it's very rare. And now you're creating ionizing pods in rare air where rest of the air particles were rapidly spread out. And that's the bite. So that's the problem that I have with the explanation. The sound will never get there to the guy because by the time that the sound gets there, there is a sound from reflection of the sound from whatever around that is coming there. Dr. Roy.
Okay, Wes, you have a chicken and the egg type of a problem now, because in order for the air to be rarefied by the arc, you have to push the air away at some point. So when you're pushing the air away to make it aerify, to have a lower density of air, you're producing sound pressures. You're producing air pressures and sound pressures, which is you're producing sound. So, you know, you would have to split the time setup to after the ionization trail superheated the gas and it expanded to maximum, which is not zero. So when you're there, if you're very close and the ionization is occurring and the heat is occurring and the enormous shock pressure wave is pushing the air away so that it's now rarefied, you're going to hear something really loud.
Could agree with you. We don't think about the vector of the sound travel. The vector of the sound travel is omnidirectional from the lightning path. So then that air that is now carrying on the sound wave is going away, not going into, and not going right below. So that's my problem. And so it's here.
I don't think I agree with you of the vector of the sound. I think it's more omnidirectional. As the lightning ionizes the gas in a rather vertical manner, it's heating up, as you mentioned, a column of gas. When a column of gas heats up and the pressure wave builds up, it builds up at a right angle to the direction of the lightning. So I don't think the vector is in line with the lightning bolt. It's actually more closely, and it's not a perfect thing because they zig and they zag, but approximately a 90-degree vector from the direction of the ionization.
Question to you is, what do you think is the pressure of the ionized gas in the lightning path? Is it more like ionosphere because of the 50,000 degrees pushing out the other particles, and then you have a thermionic reaction that is increasing that push, or is it more like just a little bit rarefied air?
Again, it's in flux. The ionosphere kind of fluctuates a little bit, but it's more in a steady state. As far as I perceive it, when the plasma strikes, the pressure drops off until it reaches approximately the same atmosphere as the surrounding air, and that's when it kind of reaches a steady state condition where the atmospheric air kind of goes back into it. So pressure, it goes very high at first and then decays down and kind of settles back eventually close to one atmosphere, whereas the ionosphere probably runs a lot lower pressure because it's higher up, it has less atmospheric pressure to it. It weighs less. It's under less weight from less of a column of gas above it.
Thank you very much for this explanation. I was taught by my professor that in some areas of lightning strike, you have a 10 to minus 10 times, 2.5 times to 10 to minus 8, which is a huge, humongous pressure. And it is rapid, it is not uniform, it is just that you have those areas. And then he was talking about solar luminescence. And he was trying to find analogy, because he was doing his PhD from actually the lightning. He was trying to find out the analogy of the rapid, humongous temperature bubble inside the water that is reacting very much similar to the lightning in the air and to a ship.
Okay, you kind of lost me when you went into the water, because now you're talking about something different, I assume.
No, the process of the pressure change in solar luminescence when you have that bubble is exactly the same in mechanism as the process of the pressure change when you have a lightning strike and you have air, which is extremely heavy. Right. It's exactly the same. The only what difference is the matter that is involved. So we have a bubble and water in solar luminescence, and we have a partial vacuum and ionized gas in this partial vacuum that is extremely, extremely vacuumed, and the air around, but it's not uniform.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I don't think you could definitively correlate the two, because in sonoluminescence, you have sonic pressure of and high-energy electrons and other things kind of confusing the situation. So I'm not quite sure if they're comparable phenomena.
No. In sonoluminescence, you have a temperature first, because of ultrasonic influence. And in lightning, you have a temperature first because of the current that found its part. So the pressure variation is a secondary effect in both of them.
I think the pressure is the phenomenon that acts on the sonoluminescence, whereas it's more of just a side effect of the lightning. I think it's an interesting thing to think of the two of them as the symmetrical mirror images in some way, but I think the phenomena are completely different, and you can't kind of gain anything understanding one and the other. They're two different phenomena that work in some interesting ways in reverse to each other. But other than that, I don't think they're comparable.
Absolutely right. The different phenomena only have the common points. But we can discuss it on my way to the Humfest with Dr. Roy. So thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Sorry for taking so much time. And to see you.
Problem, Wesley, and as Wesley reminded me to remind you guys that if you're interested, this next Sunday will be Limark's Outdoor Hamfest, and once again, in the fine tradition of the previous Hamfest, I will be bringing some of my 3D printed stuff to show people just what 3D printing can do. So I'll set up a little table, probably be near Andy, WA2CDL's tune-up table. That's where I was last time, and so please, if anyone would like to come by and say hello, I'd love to meet people. So thanks, Wes, for reminding me that. Right, let's move on to a puzzler. Recently, I was discussing a cost-performance benefit for being a warm-blooded animal. as opposed to more primitive cold-blooded creatures out there. Survival of the fittest, the principle that drives evolutionary development, is perpetually testing life for a feature's cost-performance ratio. If it's worth that price, it's in. If it's not, you're extinct. So tonight's puzzler is, the human brain makes up only 2% of the total body mass of the average human being. But the question tonight is, what is the percentage of your daily energy allotment that you burn every day to stay alive that goes to just running that lovely little brain of yours? So that's the question out there. 2% total body mass, what percentage of your total energy output do you think goes to feed that little bugger?
70%, KC2SHO.
John, what'd you say? I kind of got cut off at the beginning. It sounded like you said 90%.
Yeah, I got to remember for the RLP to latch up. 70 is my guess. 70%, 70.
Okay, that's a big overhead for a break. Anyone else with any ideas of how much your 2% of your total mass, your brain, burns each day? You know, the old saying about, why are divorces worth it? Why are divorces so expensive? And the answer is because they're worth it. Is the answer to the question in some ways. But getting back, what percentage would you guess is the total, what portion of the total energy allotment per day do you think you need to feed your brain every day?
WA2VDH, I would say, according to the size of the veins and arteries feeding it, I would say at least 50%, at least 50%.
WBT Jackson?
Oh, 50%.
Rich and John, 50%. You realize a little bit of a backstory. Many years ago, probably in Galen's time, when they didn't really have the faintest idea how we work, some people thought that the brain functioned purely as a heat exchange radiator, that its sole purpose in life was to get rid of our waste heat. So keeping that in mind, I don't exactly know how they came up with that, because you bang someone on the head, they pretty much go unconscious. So you bang a radiator someday, it still works. But I digress. Anyone else with any percentages they'd like? Yes, Rich.
I'll say 80%. I'll go high.
Gosh, you guys are very generous. I mean, you're not really leaving much for the other 98% of your body. It's a good thing evolution is a little kinder, because otherwise you'd just be flopping around on your brain.
People do that.
Okay, well, you're free to. It's a free country. There was someone else. I kind of got lost in the noise. If you want to try again.
82 MBP.
Yes, Bob. I can't quite get your percentage. What percentage are you guessing?
Oh, I didn't say it yet. Yeah, I'm going to go the other way and say like 3%. I think maybe it's a lot of low volt. I don't know about the voltage, but it's a small amount of current and stuff compared to electronic devices and stuff. I don't know. This is kind of a wild guess that it might be a small amount of energy, like say 3% or 5%.
JTV.
I'll go with 25.
You are so close. K7WJN, who's listening to us on Echolink, offers his suggestion of 40%. Before I kind of break the news on everyone, if anyone else has any percentages they'd like to promote, please feel free.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I saw in a magazine recently that I read, so I'm not going to guess, but I'm not sure what the actual number is. I don't want to guess it, because it came from a magazine. I think I'm going to pass this week. I'll have to recuse myself. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, Paul, I understand. Usually these articles tend to be decent. Occasionally they're just kind of strange and wacky. That's why I love to do a Google search and see how many wrong answers there are for the questions that I ask. Because some of them are all, you know, they're pretty much the same and they're accurate. And every so often there's a glitch in the system and there's a not terribly good answer rated the highest by Google. So once again, I'll just kind of give everyone the opportunity, one last chance, to throw out a percentage. Again, we're talking about an organ in your body that takes up 2% of the total mass of your body. So what percentage would you say?
14%.
Say again?
Somewhere around 20%. AC2LR.
Yes, you are absolutely positively right. The average percentage of the amount of calories that the brain requires, the percentage is 20%. Now, two-thirds of that is purely for your nerve cells, those lovely little neurons making all those chemoreceptor material, flushing it into the gates to activate it, retrieving it, all those lovely little ion channels of changing potassium and sodium and calcium ion concentrations. But one-third are basically maintaining glial cells. Glial cells are the housekeepers. They don't do any neurological function whatsoever. They just keep the nerve cells nice and clean and operating. So, yes, the answer is only 2% of your body, but 20% of your energy. And as I mentioned before, on an evolutionary basis, it's a big price to pay. Not as much as some of the guessers who guessed as much as 90%. But it's a lot, and it's only because it's such an effective evolutionary survival mechanism. Good cognitive function allows you to change programming, to adjust to your environment, and that's probably one of the many factors that caused the incredible success of humanity to cover the Earth with itself. So just to give you a little bit of an idea how some organs get a lot of fuel and they need it, and they pay us back in much greater survivability. So 20% is the percentage. So thanks to everyone who played this little game, and I hope you remember this little tidbit and fact.
Roy, can you hear me? This is Kay.
Yes, indeed, Kay. You win the gold star tonight. You guessed it, 20%.
And I just want to share what I knew was that most mammals, tree shrews, dogs, cats, they expend about 20%. So I guessed that the humans were about the same. That's pretty cool that it's true. But do you know how they... Like, how do you do that kind of study? How do you actually determine what amount of calories is being burned, say, if somebody's running and they're using their brain versus sitting still and using their brain? AT2LR.
Well, I must admit, I haven't gone into the experiments of how they do it. I know for the general human being of different activities, they do it by colorimetry and, just measuring heat output and what have you. I didn't really plumb the depths of the studies to find out how they got the percentages, how they measure a brain by itself. That would be an interesting thing for me to dig deep down in the internet and figure out.
Okay, very good. Thank you. AC2LR.
KGB.
KGB. You wanted to make a comment.
Oh, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I wonder if we could do that with a glucose tagged PET scan.
Well, you, you could probably gauge relative respiratory glucose use. You could get concentrations. I don't know if you could correlate it to the rest of the body. That would be somewhat more problematic, I would think. Now, those are very good in functional MRIs and such, where you see how different areas of the brain actually light up by burning more calories when you're using those areas for different cognitive skills. And so it's informed a great deal of the present understanding of neurophysiology. In the old days, the only way that you can figure out how areas of the brain function is to find people with brain damage, either stroke or trauma, and see what deficits they had and then correlate them back. But nowadays, you can have them make a drawing and do a functional MRI and see what lights up. But I don't know if that's great for qualitative. I don't know if it works for quantitative. Again, I'd have to kind of look it up and see what the results, what the measuring methods they use.
A VDH with a question?
Yes, John.
In terms of cardiac output, if you knew what is putting out and how much goes towards the brain versus the rest of the body, would that give you a rough idea? Go ahead.
Might give you an extremely rough idea. The problem is that it doesn't inherently tell you how much of the raw ingredients are absorbed and burnt, because you know basically all the blood goes through the heart. So using that kind of correlation, you would then kind of theorize that the heart uses an enormous amount of energy. So you would both need to know the flow and the percent of glucose drop, oxygen drop from between the cerebral veins and the cerebral artery. You need both of those things, not just the flow alone, because the flow may suck all the energy out of it, or may just suck 2% out of it.
How much glucose was extracted from the returning blood flow from the brain versus the returning flow from the rest of the body, or something like that, I guess. Go ahead.
That would be a method. Either the glucose or the oxygen level would probably give you an indication of the metabolic rate of the different organs. If you know the flow and you know the concentration of the fuels that we use to burn, oxygen and glucose, and especially the brain really prefers glucose over any other storage chemical, then that's probably a good way of doing it.
The only reason I mention it is that my ham shack is down in the basement, and I see the plumbing going to various fixtures, and I get an idea how much water is being used. Hi.
Hey, you know, I mean, a lot of human physiology has correlations to plumbing. Hey, any other questions, comments, what have you, before I move on to the next story?
There's a little bit something more you can do with this one, Roy. A normal human being sitting in a theater seat, when you're calculating the air conditioning requirement for a theater, 450 BTUs per hour is the amount of heat giving off by a human being. It equals roughly 120 watts. So when you're doing normal living, just sitting down and not doing heavy exercise, you're creating the metabolism of the food that you are consuming, that you've eaten, or the stored energy in your muscles and whatever, in your fat cells, a continuous 120 watts is what you're creating, consuming, eating. If 10% of that would be 12 watts and the brain is using 20%, that's 24 watts. Interesting thing to ask ourselves is the brain, during its operation, creating 24 watts of heat? Is the flow of blood through our head acting as a cooling fluid to drain off 24 watts. Now, the amount of heat created and the amount of energy being consumed, is there a one-to-one ratio? There's a bunch of questions to be asked there. So, am Am I creating 24 watts of heat inside of between my ears? How are you, Roy? K2LAW.
I would assume that ultimately the answer would be yes. All the chemical energy that's going into the working of the brain ends up as waste energy eventually. It's just that unlike the old Greeks and Romans like Galen, the brain is really not a great radiator if you think about it. It's encased in a protective skull. So it really doesn't have a great deal of surface area to dissipate heat. In point of fact, the human skin, which is considered an organ, is the principal method for regulating temperature and getting rid, dumping radiating heat. It has a large amount of vascular material covering it and a much higher surface area. So although I think that, yeah, ultimately 24 watts is getting turned into heat in the brain, I think it's being dissipated by the venous system and then shunted out through the skin circulatory system to dissipate the heat outside.
It would be an interesting experiment to measure the amount of heat being given off by the surface of your head. That's very measurable. You could also measure the temperature of the blood going into the head in the carotid artery and how much is coming back down from the veins. Is the blood coming back down from your head a degree warmer than the blood that went into your head? That would be an interesting experiment. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, I would agree with you. The idea of being warm-blooded, again, that's what kind of started me thinking about this particular question. And, you know, there's all kinds of interesting things about being warm-blooded. The temperature that we usually talk about, 98.6, has a curious history. You sort of wonder, is everyone 98.6, and isn't that a rather strange fraction to choose? And the answer is there's a little variation in humanity. Some people run a little hot, some people run a little cold, and it's not really tagged to Fahrenheit. If you look and figure out in good old centigrade, it's 37 degrees. It's a nice solid number. So they approximated it to 37 degrees centigrade, and we hear that use Fahrenheit to convert it to 98.6. But there's a little thermal variation in our body from some organ systems, and I would not be at all surprised that there's a slight differential between the cerebrovascular blood flow and the rest of the core temperature because of the higher metabolism. But yeah, that would be rather fascinating. Again, I got to do some more research on this one. I wonder if anyone's taken the trouble of doing these things. Probably they have, but it might have been so long ago that it's kind of covered in dust. People are much more interested in functional MRIs these days rather than simple things like temperatures.
I had a peculiar experience about 8 years ago. I had walked into a sharp piece of steel at nighttime in my backyard in the dark, and I took a chip out of my tibia, and that chip became separated. It pierced the periosteal sheath that separates your flesh from the bone. Your bone is not allowed to come in direct contact with flesh. Well, in my case, it did. And so this injury created an inflammation that got me into the hospital. While I'm in the hospital, they took a digital thermometer, stuck it in my mouth, and it said no reading. So they said, okay, this one's defective. They went and got a second digital thermometer, no reading. Third digital thermometer, no reading. These nurses came to the conclusion that all three of their digital thermometers had failed at the exact same time. How they believe that is beyond belief with me. They finally went and got an old-fashioned thermometer and measured my temperature. At that time, it was 95.9. I am guessing the way a digital thermometer works, because it takes an infinite amount of time for it to settle on the real temperature. I think it measures the rate at which the temperature sweeps through 96 degrees. I am guessing your testing device...
Repeater, timeout.
Its testing device starts off at room temperature is the way it settles on the temperature it indicates. Because I didn't switch through 96 degrees, it couldn't take a reading. That's my guess as to what was going on. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, I mean, that's an interesting theory. I would tend to go with a much more simplistic one, which is that the electronics discounts anything below a certain amount of temperature as an error and doesn't give you anything. So such things are not really well designed because people do come to hospitals with hypothermia, where it would be rather nice to know what temperature they were. But this might be some really badly designed thermocouple that will only register, you know, something like 97 degrees and above, and if you give it a 95 or just below 96 degrees, it just gives you an error result.
That could be. It would be interesting to study the design of those thermometers. But if you really wanted to have it measure the exact temperature that it is touching on your tongue, for instance, in theory, you've got to wait an extremely long period of time for that that exponential function to settle out. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it's that long. I mean, it's not going to reach an accurate number to 8 or 9 digits for a while, but it'll probably come close to the 2 or 3 that you need. And nowadays, also, they use infrared thermal detectors as well that pretty much have an instantaneous result. You just kind of, especially in pediatrics, you just point these things at kids' foreheads, not terribly accurate, or the inside of their ears, a little bit more accurate, and you get a number. Any other questions, comments, or what have you before I move on to my other story, which is a medical story, so this is going to be like a medical night. Okay, no. Every profession has pranks that are played upon newcomers. It was inevitable that when I rotated through ophthalmology, I was asked to examine and discuss anything unusual that I saw in one particular patient. They told me to look at his eye through a slit lamp. And, of course, no one mentioned that the guy had a glass eye. Uh-huh. Who knows how many people were sent out during their first days in construction to look for left-handed screwdrivers. So in addition to these pranks, every profession seems to have its own set of puzzles that kind of separate the men from the boys. And this next story has been a very popular left-field obscure medical puzzle. Now, I even recall seeing it used in one of the earliest medical school self-testing computer programs that I played with at the time. So this is an actual case of this obscure thing that medical science keeps on puzzling youngsters with. So let me just drop, and I will get into this light little story. Okay, one man's hot tea habit turned out to be much less relaxing than he hoped, according to his doctors. An 84-year-old Canadian ended up in the emergency department with a serious case of high blood pressure, headache, and chest pain, with the only likely cause of his symptoms being his 2 weeks straight of drinking homemade licorice root tea. But it's hardly the first time licorice has been blamed for blood pressure problems. The man's story was detailed in a case study published this past Monday in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. According to the study, the man had a long history of hypertension and cardiovascular disease, but he'd been able to keep his blood pressure in check as recently as his medical checkup. A week before he visited the hospital, though, he noticed his blood pressure had begun climbing, and nothing he did seemed to help it. But by the time doctors saw him, he had already been suffering from physical symptoms such as chest pain, fatigue, and headaches. And it's likely that things could have gotten much worse if he hadn't gotten help right then and there. Quote, in this case, the blood pressure was so high that it led to him having heart failure, swelling of the legs, and some abnormalities with his electrolytes, like potassium. End quote. Study author Lawrence Green, a internal medicine physician at McGill University Health Center, reported. There was no apparent reason why his blood pressure had spiraled out of control, but eventually the man volunteered that he had been drinking 1 to 2 glasses of homemade tea brewed from licorice root for 2 weeks before his admission to the hospital. Licorice, derived from the plant Glycyrrhiza glabra, is a part of a drink called Erksos, popular in some countries, including Egypt, and around the Muslim holiday of Ramadan. Thankfully, once he stopped drinking the licorice tea and started taking intensive blood pressure drugs, the man steadily recovered. He left the hospital in good health after 2 weeks, and a checkup of 3 weeks later found that his blood pressure was back to manageable. The man's pre-existing health certainly contributed to the danger he was in, but doctors have long known that licorice can cause or worsen high blood pressure in people. As recently as 2017, the Food and Drug Administration warned that people over the age of 40 should avoid eating too much licorice candy. According to the agency, eating more than 2 ounces of black licorice candy a day for 2 weeks straight can raise the risk of developing an irregular heart rhythm or arrhythmia in older people. Let me drop for a sec. Quote, this is not a new discovery, end quote, Green noted. It's more of an episodic reminder to doctors that licorice can cause these symptoms and that they should be aware of that. The culprit behind licorice's effect on blood pressure is the compound that gives it its slightly sweet taste, called glycyrrhizin. In high enough dosages, it causes our cells to retain more water than they should, and our body's potassium levels plummet, the net result of which drives up blood pressure. According to his doctors, the man did not know about the risks of licorice and high blood pressure, but he simply didn't suspect the tea when his symptoms first arose. While the case study is intended for doctors, Green said that there are things that the public should keep in mind as well, particularly those of us who love our red Twizzlers. Many people think they're eating licorice, but they're probably not. The red candy that's sort of shaped like licorice, that's really not licorice. There's no licorice in there whatsoever. It has to be the black licorice that's real licorice. And even then, if it's taken in moderation and you don't have high blood pressure or heart problems, you should be fine, Green said. It is theoretically possible for perfectly healthy people to develop licorice-related high blood pressure or other related problems, he added. But it would take some pretty huge quantities of licorice to pull it off. So as long as you don't do that, you're in the clear. After all the ways of going, death by licorice binge might not be the best way to go. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, is it possible that the licorice contains something that is a vasoconstrictor?
Yes, it does a bunch of things. It mimics something called antidiuretic hormone, and so it changes the way that your kidneys operate, and it gets rid of potassium and holds on to water. And as the volume increases in an enclosed volume, something's got to give, and what gives is the pressure goes up.
Do you believe that Do you believe most people will respond that way, or only certain individuals will respond to licorice that way, Roy?
Everyone has the same results to this material. It works in the same way. It depends upon the individual. If they already have a degree of high blood pressure to begin with, it's going to be a much more severe high blood pressure than if they have low or normal blood pressure. So everyone is going to have some potassium loss, some fluid retention, some blood pressure being raised. It's a combination of their underlying health and the amount of this material they consume.
What about green tea?
Tea is fine. Green tea doesn't have anything like that. It's licorice that has that one particular ingredient that mimics a hormone that our body uses to adjust our electrolyte and fluid balance. But green tea is fine. All things in moderation, obviously. You can drink enough water to kill your kidneys if you're so inclined.
So there are certain things you can consume which will aggravate hypertension. Are there things we can consume that will give us hypotension, lower blood pressure?
There are vasodilators. Most of them tend to not really work well orally. They work very nicely intravenously. And they're given to people very often when they're going through congestive heart failure. to kind of lower the pressure rather quickly, or people with severe malignant hypertension. But primarily, there are antihypertensive drugs that act as mild vasodilators and as blood pressure lowering agents. But I can't offhand think of anything as nasty as licorice that lowers your blood pressure the way that thing does. Other questions or comments, or I'll move on to the last story of the night. We talked about the death of noted physicist Stephen Hawking when he died, and I thought that the great physicist Murray Gell-Mann warranted the same service. Pioneering physicist Murray Gell-Mann passed away at the age of 89 years of age. Among his many scientific contributions, the Nobel laureate will be remembered for bringing order to the chaotic field of particle physics and for coining the term quark, a fundamental building block of matter. Gell-Mann was a giant who helped to make sense of the very small. Winner of the 1969 Nobel Prize in Physics, he developed a classification scheme called the Eightfold Way that finally gave order to elementary particles. He helped to develop the idea of quarks while making significant contributions to the standard model of particle physics, which is used for explaining and predicting a wide variety of physical phenomena. The field of particle physics in the late 1950s and the early 1960s was often described as a particle zoo, littered with more than 100 so-called elementary particles that had been either predicted by mathematical theory or observed in experiment with particle accelerators. In 1961, Gell-Mann and Yuval Nemin independently proposed a scheme for ordering these subatomic particles onto clusters of 8 and 10 based on a symmetry called SU3, called the Eightfold Way, which Gell-Mann poetically named after the Buddhist Eightfold Path to Enlightenment, has been likened to the Mendeleev periodic table of elements in chemistry because it classified subatomic particles like protons, neutrons, mesons, baryons into groups with similar and related properties. Furthermore, it describes their interactions and, equally important, opens the door for predicting the existence of newer particle states, which were subsequently discovered. Let me drop for a second. Gell-Mann was subsequently awarded the 1969 Nobel Prize in Physics for his contributions and discoveries concerning the classification of elementary particles and their interactions. The new classification scheme inspired Gell-Mann to predict the existence of a previously undocumented elementary particle. This hypothetical building block of neutrons and protons were dubbed quarks by Gell-Mann, who borrowed the word from James Joyce's novel Finnegan's Wake. Specifically, the reference to three quarks for Muster Mark. Later, using the Stanford Linear Accelerator, quarks were proven to exist, according to the Santa Fe Institute. Quote, Murray Gell-Mann was a seminal figure in the history of physics, said Caltech President Thomas Rosenbaum in a Caltech statement. A polymath, a discerner of nature's fundamental patterns, and as such an expositor for the connections of physics to other disciplines. Murray helped define the approaches of generations of scientists. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Yeah, you talk through your hat.
Decisive comment. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and this has been the Science Talk, and as always, I do appreciate everyone who participated, and even those who listen, and we'll do it all over again next week, and as I mentioned, next Sunday morning, I'll be at the Limark Outside Hamfest showing off the magic that is 3D printing, so if anyone is there, come by and say hello. So once again, mailbag questions, comments, questions, topics, refutations, what have you. Email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links to the stories that I mentioned will be appearing on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. So thanks to everyone for participating. And over to Dick so he can... bring it over to Paul for the space report.
Good material, Roy. And if my head is dissipating 24 watts, and I'm not getting the right amount of cooling, does that make me a hothead? Paul, WS2N, what's NASA doing these days? And how are those 60 satellites doing? Boy, to deploy 60 satellites with one rocket, and each one is quite a large number of pounds. That is quite a feat. WS2N, KQRIW, you got it, Paul.
This is WS2N, and very good. Yeah, okay, on the Starlink program. Yeah, 60 satellites, each one 500 pounds. Each one had a Hall thruster, you know, one of these ion thrusters. And that's only scratching the very bottom of the barrel. I'm telling you, there's going to be 12,000 of these things if Elon Musk has his own way. So that's his goal. It could eventually give the astronomers problems on Earth. I know in Chile already they're saying, you know, that when they have these long exposures looking at the sky, they're starting to see some of the satellites, you know, crossing the view. So it could be interfering with them in the future. And, you know, right now that's okay, but imagine 12,000. This is only 60. I think there's only like something like, you know, 5,000 operating satellites. So this is going to easily triple that. And the reason I say triple is they're not the only ones planning on doing this. Jeff Bezos plans on manufacturing satellites, and he's going to do the same thing. OneWeb or Web1, what do they call it? I forget which way it is, but that's another one. I think they only want 600 satellites to start. So that's the way it goes. If it works out, you're going to have a couple of billion people that never had the capability of getting on the internet get on the internet worldwide. So that's the upside. Let me drop it. Okay, one of the missions that are going up very shortly is a military mission, an advanced, extremely high-frequency military communication satellite. It's the fifth one of a group, and they've all been launched by Atlas V rockets. ULA, United Launch Alliance, launches these things. This will be a 5-5-1 configuration. That means that you're going to use a 5-meter diameter fairing. That means it's a big satellite. That's the biggest one. And then they're going to have five solids attached to the Atlas V, and one Centaur upper stage rocket. That's liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen propelled. And it's going to be running off the RD-180 right engine that's at the bottom of the that's the main booster. Once that gets off the ground, right now they're assembling it for probably a July launch down in Florida. They launch from Launch Complex 41. And right after that, they're going to get to work on the next important launch, as far as I'm concerned, is going to be the first Boeing Starliner launch. The CST-100 is what they used to call it. Now they gave it a name, Starliner, by Boeing. And they're going to assemble that, and that's going to have a different configuration. It's not going to have a fairing, because you're going to have a spacecraft on top. If you had a fairing and there was an emergency, the spacecraft wouldn't be able to break away from the booster. And then you're going to have, instead of five solid rockets like this launch I just talked about, it's going to have two solid boosters attached to it. And the difference with the upper stage, instead of having the Centaur one rocket, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen rocket, you're going to have two. That'll be the first time that they run that on the Atlas V. So it's a different setup, but it's going to be powerful enough to get to the international space station without a crew. and this will eventually be able to launch four people at a time. Their first launch will, if this goes well, in August, as they're hoping for. They hope for a manned launch by the end of the year. And Boeing's a little different than SpaceX. When SpaceX, when they first get their crew up there, they plan on first sending a crew of just two and stay for a couple of weeks. Not Boeing, they plan on sending a crew of three up and making it a long duration mission. They, you know, they might stay up there for 4, 5, 6 months before they come back. That's the present plan for Boeing, though. But hopefully that goes well. Recently in March, SpaceX did the same thing. They took the Dragon spacecraft and they launched it to the space station, and all went well. It was unmanned, not the cargo version. It was the crew version. If you put somebody in there, they would have made it up there. They docked with the space station for about a week, and then they eventually undocked. When they were docked, they had people go inside. They took supplies that were inside out, and they conducted interviews with the press from inside the space station. So that went very good. They deorbited it. They came back, landed in the Atlantic Ocean. Usually Dragon lands in the Pacific, but this time they plan on landing in the Atlantic, which they did successfully. And they brought the vehicle back to Florida. So they planned on using the same exact vehicle that was unmanned on their orbital abort test. They have to pass certain milestones with NASA to certify the vehicle, and so does Boeing. And a couple of things that they have to do is they have to show that they could launch the just the crew portion of the vehicle away from the booster if it's just sitting on land, sitting at the launch complex. And SpaceX has accomplished that, but they haven't done the in-flight abort test yet. So they plan on doing that. They had planned on doing it like this month. So they took that crewed vehicle that went up to the space station after it came back, and they brought it back to Florida, and they put it on a test stand in Florida on one of their launch complexes, or one of their landing zones. They call it Landing Zone 1. SpaceX took over a launch complex. Originally it was called Launch Complex 13. Anyway, they got rid of everything there, and they put two big, concrete landing zones, so they were able to land their boosters back at Florida when they launched, which they've done quite a few times already. So they decided, well, let's use this particular landing zone one to test out the thrusters and make sure everything's working before we actually put the spacecraft back onto a booster to test for an abort. So, what, about 3 weeks ago, they did that. They attached the spacecraft, and they started testing the, I think they have 24 little thrusters. You know, they want to make sure they all worked. They worked, and then they decided, well, let's test the main thrusters. They call Super Dracos. The small ones are Dracos, and the main ones are pulling away from a booster, whether sitting on the ground or in flight, are called Super Dracos, and they each develop like 40,000 pounds thrust. So you add them all up, it comes out to like 120,000 pounds thrust. And right before they lit it off, the whole thing blew up. I mean, there was nothing left of the spacecraft. So unfortunately, that was a failure. They're looking into the cause of it. The information hasn't been released yet, and I've been looking forward to, you know, finding out what caused this. I have my own theories, but we'll have to wait and see. In the meantime, that delays everything, of course. They were working on another crewed vehicle in California, getting it ready for the actual flight, where you were going to put two astronauts in there. Now that's been canceled. They're taking that same spacecraft that they were going to use, and they're going to take that and use that for the orbital in-flight abort test. And they say that should be coming up soon. I don't know when, but that's their big plan. There's another vehicle.